This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch rural broadcasting system in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to the February monthly edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. It's very nice to have you with us. As you're probably aware, in case you're hearing the show for the first time, there are two versions of this program. There's the weekly 30-minute version and then a 55 or 60-minute version that we do monthly. Well, we're going to begin today to focus on the media in Russia. Now, the media in Russia has changed a lot in the last 30 years. During Soviet times, well, everything was controlled and there was a lot of censorship. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, and probably towards the late 80s, things started to change when the Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev introduced Perestroika and Glasnost. Of course, these changes continued under Boris Yeltsin, and in the 1990s, especially the mid-1990s to around 1997, media in Russia was very open and very free. But then comes along President Vladimir Putin, who, well, for every one step that was taken forward by Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, took five steps backward. The media landscape in Russia today is very different from what it was 15 years ago. We're seeing journalists that are disappearing and even being killed. The Russian government has decided to, well, bring together all of the Russian media outlets, national that is, to have more control. They're being dictated on what to report and what not to report. Now, we're in the midst of the 2014 Sochi Winter Games. There's been a lot of controversy around Sochi because of the corruption involved in the construction of all the new Olympic venues. But this is something that Russian media hasn't been reporting on, or rather, they have been reporting on it to a very, very small degree. To find out more on what the media in Russia has been like around the Sochi 2014 Games, we have this special report from Richard Ady.
As we count down to Sochi, it's time to get excited and get behind our athletes.
Russia's Olympic City has been rehearsing its fireworks display.
It also alleges contracts for the most expensive facilities were given to companies close to President Vladimir Putin.
As hordes of journalists arrive to cover the games, many discover their accommodations are not yet ready.
First of all, don't worry about the snow. Snow will be guaranteed.
Guaranteed?
Yeah.
Actually, you're not about to hear a great deal about the Winter Olympics. There'll be plenty on that over the next couple of weeks. Instead, we're going to look at journalism in Russia, one of the most difficult countries in the world to be a reporter or editor. It's no longer a communist totalitarian state, but it's still incredibly secretive. There's no real freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And it's dangerous. 18 journalists have been murdered in the last 10 years, overwhelmingly while they were covering corruption, crime, politics and business, which in Russia are all intertwined. So where to start? Well, the obvious place, Sochi. The Committee to Protect Journalists has recently put out a report on the journalism covering the build-up to the Games. Its author is Nina Ognianova.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to Sochi and the preparation for the Olympics that unfortunately has become concealed for the Russian media and therefore for the Russian public. The exploitation of migrant workers is one of the abuses that has stained preparation for the Olympics, along with corruption, damage to the environment, eviction of local Sochi residents whose homes have come to be on the path of Olympic construction, adoption of a series of laws that restrict freedom of the press and freedom of expression and run contrary to the Russian constitution, a slew of sensitive issues such as high-level corruption in the business sector, the bankruptcy of local business in the process of the, again, of the Olympic preparation, and the overall just inconvenience, day-to-day inconvenience for local residents who have come to experience things like long-lasting power outages, water shortage, colossal traffic jams, and so on and so forth.
That is a long list. But I'm wondering if those sorts of issues are usually covered by the Russian media, like outside of covering the build-up to the Olympics, or does Sochi present a neat example of everything that the media in Russia is struggling with?
Well, you know, Russia has never been a shining example of freedom of expression and press freedom. But in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics, the extent of the censorship and the extent of the pressure on all independent voices has reached a new high. Whereas some of these issues have been covered by regional media, by definitely some of the mainstream print media in Russia before, you know, issues like human rights abuses, corruption, and so on and so forth. Now we are seeing a sort of total blackout for information that's negative and that comes out of the Olympic city, to the extent that Russian media cover the games the way that they would cover a deceased person, in positive light or not at all.
When you went through that list, so mistreatment of migrant workers, corruption, environmental damage, eviction of locals without adequate compensation, those are terrific, meaty stories. If you're a journalist in a place like Sochi, which I think is about 350,000 people, it's not huge, but it will have a local journalism community. You should know about those things and be dying to tell your readers and viewers and listeners about them.
Well, everyone knows about these issues. They're not a secret for the journalists or for the local residents. It's just that most of the media locally are either owned or completely dependent on the municipal budget. So they're financed by the local government. They depend on the state for their advertisement revenue and their livelihood. Their staying on the air or staying in print depends on whether they get those state subsidies. That means that they do toe the line that the local government and the federal government by extension is formulating for them and is formatting for them as framework of coverage.
What about what amounts to the national media in Russia? Can't they go after these stories?
Well, you know, the national television stations are all either state-owned or state-controlled, and the majority of the population in Russia is getting their stories and their news from the national broadcasters. They are not covering the Olympics in a negative light, period. When it comes to the mainstream media that are privately owned, many of them are still owned by Kremlin-friendly figures, oligarchs, business people. And so there is an internal kind of directive not to anger the authorities, not to spoil the image of Russia in the run-up to this mega event, which should make everyone proud. There was one newspaper, Kommersant, which translates to business person, and it's the biggest and most influential business daily in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very professional newspaper. It usually does cover the kind of front page stories that the New York Times would cover or any big newspaper in the world would cover. But when it comes to the Olympic story, they too have been gagged. In one specific case, a prominent journalist was tasked to cover the eviction of Sochi residents because of Olympic construction. She did a terrific series on that subject. And even though her editor and her newsroom were pressured to check the story, the editor decided not to bow to the pressure and went ahead with the story and published the series. Very shortly after that, he was fired on a different pretext. But his colleagues say that he was fired because of not bowing down to pressure when it comes to covering the Olympics. And that prominent correspondent who bylined the stories was then taken off the Sochi story.
Nina Ognianova from the Committee to Protect Journalists. More from her later. To understand the latest version of Russia's repressive media climate, you have to go back a couple of years to the end of 2011, after the parliamentary elections, but before the presidential poll that would return Vladimir Putin to the Kremlin. There were huge public protests, and Norman Hammond had a ringside seat as the ABC's Moscow correspondent.
Some of it, if you can recall, was almost unprecedented. I mean, these rallies were so large in scope, people hadn't seen anything like this in the Putin era, certainly, that state television and networks that are generally sympathetic to the Kremlin had no choice to report these rallies. I mean, normally these sorts of protests are given very little coverage, but they were so large that they would have been laughingstocks had they not reported on them. So they actually had to report on the rallies, and it was quite extraordinary seeing not only the big Russian networks, the state networks, but even networks like NTV, which is nominally an independent network, reporting on these rallies and what was happening not only in Moscow but in big cities across the country. So there was this really brief moment where it looked like the media was liberalizing incredibly quickly, and people were thinking back to the heady days of sort of the mid 1990s when there was this brief period of extremely free media, especially in the mass media, the broadcast media in Russia. And then, of course, as the protest movement started to wane, that changed very quickly.
So once he was elected again, what happened?
Well, that was in May 2012. Mm. And then during the summer, typically what happens is most Russian cities, particularly Moscow, sort of shut down for the summer. The people involved, as funny as it may sound, these people are running a protest movement for the very future of the country, but many of them took extended vacations through that summer and were out of the country. And it lost a lot of momentum. And while that was happening, the media crackdown sort of took place. A lot of that coverage we had been seeing in the mainstream broadcast media sort of disappeared. And there were a number of essentially hit jobs done by either public networks or Kremlin-friendly networks on protest leaders, documentaries about how they had accepted money, all aimed at discrediting the leaders of the protest. And it was for people who remembered Soviet times, there was a real air of familiarity to it because it did look like a Kremlin-orchestrated campaign in the mass media to try and discredit the opposition. And to a large extent, it really was successful because outside of Moscow, many people just started to consider people involved with the opposition, the leadership, as no better than the people in the Kremlin and just somehow trying to get power through another means. So that consistent drumbeat of coverage did seem to sort of wear down the leadership of the opposition.
But reporting critically has become harder too. There's now defamation's now criminal again. You've got things like websites that are blacklisted for carrying unlawful content, which can be interpreted almost however it suits anyone in authority to interpret it. Treason's now been defined so vaguely that it could be that any information shared with an international journalist is an act of espionage.
I think the key, Richard, is it doesn't even have to get that far. If you look at what's happening right now to Dosht TV, Rain Television, which was probably the most independent network in Russia, it was on... It's a small operation that is primarily internet-based and then is carried on cable networks and satellite networks across Russia and developed a very large following during these protests. And without any of these draconian measures that you're speaking of, they've managed to essentially silence it by putting huge amounts of pressure on cable operators to simply drop the channel. And that's exactly what's happened. So it's now been left to an internet stream. Now, an internet stream in Russia is very good for people who want to see it in Moscow and a few other big cities. But the vast majority of Russians still get their news and information from broadcast media.
Mm-hmm.
And broadcast media is really the key. So once you remove an opposition or an independent voice from broadcast media, it essentially has been removed from the national debate. And that's exactly what they've been moving to do.
So you've been, while you were there doing your own reporting, of course you were seeing what was happening to Russian journalists reporting for Russian outlets. In the teeth of these law changes and heavy pressure, how did they respond?
Well, sadly, a number of journalists simply complied. Others continue to fight on, but you know, it's a very complicated picture. For instance, one of the most well-known independent liberal democratic voices in Russia is Echo Radio in Moscow, which is a radio station and has a cable TV network as well that's mostly seen by people over the internet. And it has always operated freely. It continues to ask tough questions of the Kremlin, but there's always been this allegation that it is sort of permitted to operate as an outlet for liberal democratic thought, that it's a way for the Kremlin to be able to point to Westerners and to critics and say, we do allow this kind of discussion. Because when you go outside of Moscow to the rest of Russia, you know, these kind of networks have almost no influence. Virtually, they're not part of the popular conversation. No one is really thinking about them, talking about them. So there are networks like that that exist in isolation. There's other examples of things that happened. For instance, when we were in Russia and we did some reporting on this, there was a media personality. Her name is Ksenia Sobchak, and she comes from a very well-connected family within the Kremlin. And she very sensationally adopted the protests as one of her cause. And she was doing a lot of work on popular television. She wasn't a serious news person, but she would have, you know, was very well-known personality on things like what we have in Australia, you know, Australia's Got Talent, being a judge. She was everywhere in the magazines. And within 2 months, she had nothing. She was not on the airwaves anywhere, except for Dosht TV, Rain TV, where she had a show. But essentially, she talked to us very frankly about her career had essentially been reduced to one gig in a matter of months. And it was all due to pressure put on broadcasters from the Kremlin to make these people disappear from the public view, people who supported sort of the protest movement.
Norman Hammond. It's easy to see why the mainstream media hasn't distinguished itself covering Sochi. But according to Nina Ognianova, this has left space for smaller, independent journalists.
That is a phenomenon that has emerged out of the mainstream media silence on Sochi. The local activists, we're talking about environmental activists, rights defenders, even lawyers who defend migrant workers who have been robbed of their salaries or who have been defending evicted residents. This community of brave individuals have taken on the task that usually falls upon journalists. They have been doing that via social networks, in blogging platforms, on YouTube, and they have been doing that at a great risk for themselves and their own livelihood, as well as for the livelihood of their families. When we did our report, we spoke with many of these activists, and they shared with us their personal stories of harassment, intimidation, bureaucratic raids that they have experienced because they have refused to keep their mouth shut about the evictions, about the corruption, about the environmental damage, and all of the other issues that we just talked about.
Nina Ognianova from the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Russia is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists.
A Russian newspaper reporter died earlier this month when he fell out of an apartment block window.
The very first cup of tea completely incapacitated me. I lost consciousness practically straight away.
Anna Politkovskaya was shot dead outside her Moscow apartment. The 48-year-old won praise and made high-powered enemies with her reporting on Russia's war in Chechnya and for her criticism of the Putin presidency.
His old desk is now a memorial and the story has been shelved.
We want the real murderers to be found.
And now most of the journalists don't speak up what they think.
Ivan Safronov's death made the pages of his newspaper, but few other Russian media bothered to report it.
If you're a Russian journalist, asking too many questions can get you killed. It's different if you're an American foreign correspondent. The worst thing that can happen is being expelled, though that hasn't occurred since the days of the Cold War. Until last Christmas, that is, when David Satter, a veteran of three stints in Moscow, was kicked out. But it's not only what was done, it's the way it was done. In a very carefully worded statement, he was told that competent organs had determined his presence was undesirable.
The last time an American correspondent was expelled was 1982, when Andrew Nagorsky of Newsweek was expelled. But I've been covering Russia, covering the Soviet Union, actually, for almost four decades. And during that time, I don't know of a single case in which this kind of phrasing was used to justify the expulsion of a correspondent. This is the kind of phraseology that's used when you're talking about espionage. So it was very unusual.
So why did it happen, David?
Well, of course, only the FSB and only the Russian authorities know for sure. I can only guess. In the 3 months that I was in Russia, I simply did not have time to do anything that was that significant. Most of those 3 months were spent setting up an apartment, opening a bank account, taking care of various bureaucratic details. I wrote a couple of articles, but it would certainly not have been enough in and of itself to justify an expulsion. I think it was their assessment of what I've done in the past and what they thought I was capable of doing in the future.
Yes.
That's my best guess.
If their concern was what you'd done in the past, they had a fair bit to choose from, didn't they? But I'm wondering if, in particular, it was the very pointed questions that you've asked about the apartment bombings of 1999, which turned out to be important in the rise of Putin eventually to the presidency, that might have been the key problem.
It's very possible, because the apartment bombings were discussed in my book, Darkness at Dawn, which came out in 2003. The Russian authorities reacted in my case by pretending that what I said didn't exist. But in the case of other people, Russians, who raised the same issues, they dealt with them in a much different way. For example, Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned with a radioactive isotope in London. Yuri Shekhachihin, a Russian journalist, was poisoned. Sergei Yushchenkov, another person who raised this issue, was shot and killed. So this is obviously a very sensitive question.
Well, that's it. And perhaps I should get you to explain why, because we're talking about hundreds of people being killed at these bombings. I think the Chechens...
300.
The Chechens were blamed, but there are at least questions about whether the FSB, so state security, which was then headed by Putin, or he'd perhaps just left there, might not have been responsible themselves.
Well, absolutely. There were four bombings in three cities, two in Moscow, one in Buynaksk, which is in Dagestan, and one in the city of Volgodonsk. And then a fifth bomb was discovered in the basement of an apartment building in Ryazan. It's a city southeast of Moscow. And the local police acted quickly, and the persons who put the bomb in the basement were caught. But to the surprise of everyone, they didn't turn out to be Chechens. They turned out to be agents of the FSB. Now, how do you explain that?
Training exercise, I believe, is what was said at the time.
What was said at the time, but it certainly didn't resemble a training exercise when it took place, and a training exercise can't be conducted with a live bomb. And the bomb was tested, and it tested positive for hexagon, the same explosive that was used in the other bombings.
David, one of the things that occurs to me as you tell this story is that you mentioned the other journalist who asked the hard questions. Three of them are dead. They were Russian. You're alive. You're American. Do you think that's why you are alive?
Very well, that's undoubtedly one of the reasons. We've seen that Russian journalists, Russian investigators, Russian writers are very vulnerable, much more vulnerable than representatives of Western media.
How would you assess their vulnerability if you think, I think something like 18 Russian journalists have been killed in the last 10 years. Are Russian journalists safer now than they were, say, 10 years ago when Putin had fairly recently risen to the top?
No, not at all, because there have been recent cases of either journalists or human rights activists being murdered. For example, Mikhail Beketov in the Khimki region, who wrote about corruption surrounding the construction of a road, projected construction of a road connecting Moscow and Leningrad through the Khimki forest, was savagely beaten and left an invalid and died ultimately from his injuries. And Natalia Estemerova in Grozny was taken out. She was not a journalist herself, but she collected information about human rights abuses and made that information available to journalists. She was kidnapped from her office in Grozny in Chechnya and taken out and murdered and assassinated. So no, it's not stopping. I mean, on the contrary, journalists are just as defenseless and vulnerable now as they were in the past.
All right, but what about the foreign correspondents? Are they now working in a more hostile climate?
Well, I don't think it is hostile in the direct sense, because the Russian authorities try to manipulate and influence the foreign press. And the foreign reporters in Moscow, even those who speak Russian, and many of them do now, oftentimes are at a disadvantage when it comes to penetrating Russian society. They obviously have a tough time knowing Russia as well and in as much depth as Russian reporters do. So what the authorities try to do is to kind of influence them, give them privileged access in return for cooperation, avoiding controversial subjects. Some are invited to the Valdai Discussion Club, so-called, at which they can meet high-level Russian officials who in effect propagandize them. It's a struggle for most foreign reporters really to penetrate the surface of the society.
Which might be why David Satter has his problem, because he's better able than most to do exactly that. Of course, not all foreign correspondents are invited in for drinks and propaganda. Nina Ognianova says one or two have been seriously harassed.
The case with a Norwegian two-person crew for TV2, which is the official Olympic broadcaster for Norway.
Mm. They were detained and threatened, weren't they, those two?
That's right. So Øystein Bogen, a reporter, and his cameraman were traveling in southern Russia through the Republic of Adygia on the way to Sochi to interview local sources about the impact of the Olympics on their lives when in a period of 48 hours they were stopped six times and they were detained three times. During this very unpleasant ordeal, local police intimidated them, threatened to jail them, at some point refused to allow them to call their embassy. Even in one drastic episode, a local policeman tried to force the reporter Bogan to take a drug test. He refused to do so, but the stress and the level of obstruction, I have to say, was unprecedented for an international crew.
Now that was Nina Ognavania speaking to Richard Ady. You're listening to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, last week was a very special day in the world of radio. That was February the 13th, otherwise known as World Radio Day. Leading up to World Radio Day, the weekly edition of the program presented some of the messages sent in by radio stations from around the world that were uploaded to the website for World Radio Day. Before I get to that, let's take a listen to what Irina Bokova, the director of UNESCO, said about World Radio Day.
Today we celebrate radio as a force for freedom of expression and pluralism, for all men and women, and especially women who remain underrepresented in newsmaking, in decision-making, and in media ownership. How can we get the full story with only half of the world's voices? This is why UNESCO is working to develop radio as an independent and pluralistic media for both women and men, and to create a safer environment for all journalists, regardless of gender. Radio can carry any message to any place, at any time. We need to fully harness this power for the benefit of everyone. In this spirit, UNESCO calls today on all broadcasters, from local community stations to international media outlets, to promote gender equality and the empowerment of women and men both in and through radio. This is UNESCO's message on World Radio Day.
That was Irina Bokova, the director of UNESCO, giving her annual speech about World Radio Day. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, on the weekly edition of the program, we were broadcasting messages that were sent in from radio stations, quote-unquote, around the world, and uploaded to the World Radio Day website. Well, I spent approximately 1 hour and 15 minutes going through messages. And then I noticed something very strange. The vast majority of the messages seemed to be from France, Romania, and then maybe a few tossed in from Turkey, Egypt, and a few other countries as well. Now, I was trying to create a sort of variety for the messages that we were using on the program, but the odd thing is there were very few from the United States, Canada, Australia, none from Singapore. There was only one from Taiwan, and that was the one that we uploaded. None from Hong Kong, none from China, none from New Zealand, none from South Africa, none from Cuba, none from Russia. Oh, no, that's not true. There were a couple from Russia. There were practically none from anywhere else. So I kind of wonder, was or is World Radio Day a success? Many people, after I posted on the Facebook page that World Radio Day is happening in a few hours from now, said, oh, I didn't even hear anything about it. There weren't even any messages from the United Kingdom, let alone the BBC or the VOA or Radio Australia. So I really wonder, is it really successful? Because how can you have a quote-unquote World Radio Day when the participants are just from a small handful of countries? Very odd indeed. And I'm sure that this is something that we have to look into. I think we really, really do. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Well, something that I always enjoy doing is talking to people who've been listening to international broadcasting for many, many years. You get a different insight to those who work in the media, and also a very different insight to those who, let's say, are DXers. I'm talking about the regular SWL, the shortwave listener who tunes in to a wide variety of stations from around the world to get news and information. Now, 30 years ago, we really only had one choice, and that was shortwave. Of course, the internet came along and satellite television, and things started to change. And they changed rather fast. But there still is content out there. So how do people who were listening the traditional way incorporate the new modern technology that's out there to get information? Now, something that I have heard from a number of people is, let's say, we take The Voice of Greece. The Voice of Greece is one of those stations that, if it was to leave the bands, to be honest, I don't think anybody would miss it, because you can find more information about Greece and what is going on in Greece on the websites that are out there. Now, people will say, yes, but what about the millions of people that don't have access to the internet? Well, that's partially true, but if you look at the content from The Voice of Greece and who it targets, I seriously doubt that somebody sitting, let's say, in Angola or Kenya is going to say, well, I have to find out what's going on in Greece, so I'm going to tune into them. So a lot of these stations, like Greece, Romania, and others, have predominantly a European, North American audience, where, of course, we've seen listener figures drop. To find out from a basic, I'm not going to use the word simple because he's certainly not a simple person, SWL, somebody who I've known for more than 20 years. His name is Boris Shidov, and first started listening to the bands in the late 1970s.
Which I still have. It was a Cambridge radio originally from the UK that we brought over from the UK, made by Pi from 1958. And if a lot of the people in your audience do remember, a lot of the radios that were in existence in those times worked on valves.
And for our American audience, yeah, that's tubes. Radio tubes, yeah. Yeah.
Radio tubes that were the predecessor of the transistors that you see in modern radios now. And actually, that radio is still working fantastically well, and you can still pick up shortwave stations.
And just a question, does it have the green magic eye?
It has the famous green magic eye that comes together. There are two parts of it. It's difficult to describe to the audience listening, but I would say it's something like from maybe from James Bond 007, something akin to a radar. But what you see on TV when a ship is going in, you know, in difficult waters, there's the radar screen. What happens is when you have tuned the station perfectly, the two parts of that radio come together. So yes, it does have the famous green eye. One of the things it also has is also the famous plate. It's a plate that was a feature in the radio that would give you the positions of all the stations in Europe. So, for instance, if you wanted to listen to Radio Luxembourg in those days, or Radio Caroline, or Moscow, you would actually tune the, I would say, the side bar, I think that's the closest term, that would move up and down, and then it would fix in. So, for instance, if you're looking for London or Paris, you would move that dial to Paris until you saw this sidebar touch Paris. That means you were tuned in, but
yeah, but you know, I've noticed, and I've heard this from a lot of people, Bob Zanotti, who's a contributor here, worked at Swiss Radio International. He said that sidebar for him never worked. He said go to Moscow. I think it was just for decoration more than anything.
It was just for decoration. In the UK in those days, in the early 70s, you had BBC Radio 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they did have fixed frequencies on the medium wave band.
Yeah, but international broadcasters change frequencies.
That's right. So they were the only ones that were accurate. Everything else was not accurate. And as the Cold War progressed, all those frequencies changed radically, so it was not accurate. But that radio has a 12-inch wide speaker, so the sound coming from that is just immaculate.
Well, that's one thing, actually, about the old radios that I like, right, is the sound from
that's
them.
Right.
But the thing that I don't like about them is today,
with the modern digital radios. The radios, you can just punch in the frequency, it locks into the frequency. You don't get the drifting or anything like that. And you know, today there's so much static out there.
Exactly.
Not too long ago, a friend of mine, he has a Telefunken, a very old Telefunken. It still works. And I was noticing that after a few minutes, it would slightly drift off frequency, something, of course, that the new radios have resolved.
They've resolved, yeah. That radio does, you know, obviously it will go off frequency. You hear the distortion that is very, you know, prevalent. That's part of the beauty of shortwave listening, is all the distortion and the noises and number stations that you hear in shortwave. I mean, that's all the thrill of listening to shortwave. With the digital tuners, I think that, you know, obviously you have some drifting, but it's more accurate. It's more of a computer nowadays. Just imagine that radio has a solid wood box. I think it's made of oak, and the sound coming from there is just really something else.
Now, you were born in England.
Yes.
You spent a lot. Of course, you emigrated to Canada when your parents immigrated to Canada. Your father is Russian. Your
That's
mother
right.
is Italian.
That's right. And I'm Transylvanian.
And you're Transylvanian. But let me ask you: for listening to international radio, was this the reason why? Because when your dad moved to Canada, it was a way for him, let's say, to listen. Even though Radio Moscow was putting out garbage, was it just a way so that he could just hear the garbage they were putting out?
Well, that was, you know, we're looking at the early 80s, and that was a time when shortwave and international broadcasting was at its peak. And it also, you know, some of our younger listeners might not realize it, but that was pre-digital and pre-internet days. So there was no way of getting information outside of the country. The only way of getting that information was over shortwave. And so if you wanted to listen to the BBC, you wanted to listen to Radio Moscow in North America, or listen to Radio Moscow in Russian, that was the way to go.
You know, something that I think a lot of the younger audience who, let's say, are not familiar with international broadcasting, you know, the generation, the Facebook generation, where today you type a message, everyone gets it in some... Wait. Something I think that the younger generation today, who, let's say, don't know what shortwave is, had never heard of Radio Moscow. I was having this discussion with someone, and I said, you know, in some ways, these international broadcasters, be it Radio Moscow, Radio Canada International, Radio Australia, it doesn't matter who, they all had mailbag programs where people would write in, letters and comments were used on air. In some ways, if you think about it, it's almost like a very primitive version of social media.
Exactly. It was a very primitive way of social media and communicating in those days. And you had different stations. I think there was even a program on the BBC World Service, I forget the name, where they would answer listeners' questions, and they would receive letters from all over the world. I think I must have written in once or twice. Radio Moscow had the famous, I think it was called Moscow Mailbag.
With Joe Adamov.
Exactly. And those were just such fun shows to listen to, with different opinions. And what can I say? I mean, people used to use snail mail and didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. Now what we have, you know, in the digital age, obviously everything is instantaneous. And I think the new generation out there, they don't know how blessed they are that they can switch on a PC or a Mac and listen to the BBC World Service or any other station instantly or instantaneously.
But something I think that people don't know how to do anymore, and that's sit down with a piece of paper and pen, write a letter, write the address on the envelope, and send it. I mean, I actually, myself, I still enjoy doing that every now and again. It is different, you know, and I think that when you write a letter that way, you actually take more care with what you write. When you write on a keyboard,
yes.
You know, it's like with most of the new technologies out there. I mean, look, we take cameras, for example. When you were using film, you know, you just didn't take picture after picture after picture.
Exactly.
You know, you saved a little. So that was sort of, getting back to international broadcasting, that was sort of your introduction into it and everything.
Well, that was my introduction, was to be able to get some news from the UK, from Europe, that was lacking in Canada at that time. Obviously, in 2012, it's a different world. Communication is instantaneous. But I think also the audience must realize, a lot of people probably also remember, what thrill it was to tune a radio dial on the shortwave bands in those days, where there were literally hundreds and hundreds of stations from all over the world, and actually be able to listen to the BBC or Moscow or any other station, sometimes under difficult conditions at different times of the day when that station was not broadcasting to your region or area. Mm-hmm. Was something else. It was a thrill to find that signal, to find and listen to that station.
The station that I remember the most, because I got such a thrill when I heard it for the first time, was Radio RSA, Radio South Africa. And they had that Twitter bird that
they
used to make that
beautiful jingle. I don't know if you have an archive of that. It's in my mind, but obviously we'd have to find that on the internet. Yeah. But that was
the one that I remember. What about yourself? What do you remember, the first thing that you heard? Radio Moscow, right?
There would be obviously the Big Ben on the BBC, and also the chimes of the Kremlin bells. Things like that were certainly indistinguishable. If you heard those birds twittering from South Africa, you would know that was Radio RSA.
Right. Just like, for example, Yankee Doodle Dandy on The Voice of America, exactly. The first four notes of O Canada,
exactly.
or the trumpet voluntary that the BBC World Service used to play.
Exactly. And those songs and tunes so define the radio stations. And I think in essence, they are very iconic of that age. Of the 80s and the mid 80s, when shortwave was at its boom.
Yeah, because nowadays very few broadcasts on shortwave have any type of interval signal. Some still do, like North Korea still has one. Radio Japan, if I'm not mistaken, but the BBC don't anymore. Nowadays they just sign on. The Voice of America still has theirs, but other broadcasters just sign on.
Well, I think that originally the intent of that was for people in those areas to be able to actually sync their watches to the tones that were being broadcast at that time.
And also when you had radios that didn't have a digital display,
exactly.
You had the slide dial, so at least you knew that if you heard that, you knew the station that was going to come on.
The station was on, and you knew, for instance, that it was 8 o'clock. Because the BBC would give you the time in GMT, you know, plus one, minus one, whether it's summer or winter. But you would know that you were listening to that station at a particular hour. I think nowadays with, cell phones and mobile phones and the internet, we've no need anymore to know what time it is. It's present everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Now, here at the SWL Fest, there's been a number of very interesting forums that have been taking place. There was one that we went to today, in fact, on Radio Free Asia. That was quite interesting. And there was also one on Wi-Fi radios. And they had even like the first generation of Wi-Fi radio. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, when is this thing going to load? You actually have one of those.
I have one of those. Unfortunately, my flight was delayed and I didn't arrive until the afternoon. I missed that conference, but
the one on Wi-Fi radio, you were here.
Okay,
I think it's the beer talking, Boris.
Maybe it's the beer talking. Who knows? Or it's late at night. But anyways, no, I have the first commercially sold Wi-Fi radio, which was the Acoustic Energy radio that I bought in the UK. And in those, I think a couple of years back, I paid £200 sterling. Obviously, the prices now have gone down. And at that time, when I was in the UK, obviously, I'd heard of this radio being sold, and I kind of timed my visit to the time that radio was released on the market in the UK. And I said to myself, what a marvelous invention it is to be able to access all those radio stations without the use of a computer. So that was the first radio, as I said, commercially available that let you listen to any radio station you wanted that was broadcasting or streaming from your bedroom, from your kitchen, and liberated you from sitting down in front of the PC. And I think that's quite revolutionary now. And obviously, that's moved on where people can access those streaming stations now via mobile phones.
But, you know, the first Wi-Fi radio I remember even getting my hands on, it was at a conference a long time ago. I have to tell you, I wasn't impressed. It had a menu, and it showed the BBC and other broadcasters, and every time I went to click on it, it was showing, okay, it's 1% ready, 2% ready, 3%, it was slow.
Yes. Keith, you're totally right. Obviously, in Europe and in North America, where internet speeds are fairly stable and fast, these stations will buffer and will load up quicker. That's one of the problems still inherent, but I do have a Logitech Squeezebox Wi-Fi radio, which I bought this year, and that has they've really improved on that. So basically it can buffer within a second or 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Some of the older Wi-Fi radios, one of the problems, as you say, was being able to get that station that was listed in their directory. One of the reasons being at that time was the fact that either the company would not update the URL, the new URL that station would be broadcasting on or streaming. But now what's happened is that people that do want to send in new URLs that go with the stations, they're able to log into the website and actually update those that information directly, so it makes for a quicker upswing. But I do know that Receiver, they maintain a database which is fairly decent, and VTuner also maintains a very decent database, and Logitech, if I'm not mistaken, is using the TuneIn radio database, which is very, very frequently updated. One of the problems Wi-Fi radios are having is tuning into stations in North America that will stream using the Flash Player on PC. There are not many systems, not many Wi-Fi radios that can handle that right now. One of the reasons being is that the advertisers and the station themselves want you to tune into their website and stream and listen to the station directly on their website.
But the thing is, by doing that, they're probably cutting themselves off because, it was just announced recently that that I think Adobe, that makes Flash, they said they're not going to do any more new versions at all. And, Wi-Fi radios now, there are some on the market that are portable Wi-Fi radios that are the size of an iPhone.
Yeah.
And they become so small, they're inexpensive, and they're very easy to use. Let's now move to programming on radio. There was a time when the personality, and I think this is something that everybody can identify with, any city you went to in the world, it was the personality that was on the air. Today, in many cities around the world, including Montreal where you live, you're seeing automation. Somebody goes in, they put down a few voice tracks, they could be in another city, in another time zone, and everything is pre-programmed, and it's I like to call it the McDonald's of radio. It's all pre-packaged, the fast food of radio. Yourself, what do you think of this?
I think you're totally right, Keith, in your observations. I think one of the things are, I mean, you probably have the Howard Sterns that have been around for a long time. People are going to tune in to his radio show. It's not available in Montreal, but if you do subscribe to Sirius Radio, you can listen to the broadcast. And they're tuning in for, his opinions, his personality.
Well, the thing is, we're talking about, the automated radio stations. What I don't get is, why would you do that? Because most people these days have some type of MP3 player. So why would you listen to radio for something that you can just put on your MP3 player?
Well, I think what I was going to say is that I don't think people can stay long enough in radio to develop a personality. Simply, it's so competitive in North America that things change radically. One day you're there, the next day you're gone. So the the cult of personality, sorry, of announcers that have been on the air for 20 years and more, I think that those days are gone. We're not going to see that anymore. That was more, you know, in the earlier days, in the 80s, mid-80s, you'd be able to listen to the same person on radio very frequently, especially on the BBC. They would have a lot of announcers that have been there for many, many years, and people would tune in to, like, for instance, Chris Moyle's show. He's still broadcasting. I don't listen to it. And other, you know, other broadcasters. But I think that, you know, personality radio, I think that's a thing of the past.
And with that, we end this edition, the monthly edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We would like to find out where you're listening to this show on and through what partner station. You can always contact us, mnp@pcjmedia.com, or you can listen to this version again or all past editions, including the weekly version, at our website, pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word, or through the World Radio Network at wrn.org. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.